read all of them. Always when you bring books up, people think you've done a lot of research. That's not really why I brought these up here. I'll tell you why I brought them a little later. Good to speak to you. I have a long history in this area, in the Big Sandy area, with the Church of God, in that I was one of the few and privileged people to go through 12 years of Imperial Schools with somewhat different feelings from it than some other people who went to Imperial Schools for a few years. But at the same time, I enjoyed my stay there. I started Imperial Schools in Big Sandy, Texas, because my real father had died when I was about 3 and a half in a construction accident. And Mr. Blackwell did the funeral and told my mom that because she was a widow with children, she should move to Big Sandy, which seemed to be something they told people that happened to back then. So we moved here, and I started Imperial. Had a long tenure with it, but I didn't keep staying Big Sandy. In 1960, we moved to Pasadena, and I finished Imperial Schools in Pasadena. I came back to Big Sandy in 1970 for college and stayed there long enough to get called in a few times, by Mr. McCullough and others, and left to go to Pasadena so I could pick up some new faces to get called in by. Then I graduated from Pasadena campus, and I was supposed to go out as a trainee in the field in Salt Lake City. When on the graduation day at brunch, Mr. Armstrong called me. Of course, those days was a formal brunch, and if you got called during brunch, nobody got paged during brunch. When I got paged during brunch, I thought I'd really got done something major. And then when Mr. Armstrong was on the phone, of course, first thing he said was, "You know who this is?" Well, that wasn't hard to know who that was. He had no idea I was who I was, but I guess he figured if I answered the page, I must be. And he said, "Well, Aaron, I want you to fly with me." I said, "Well, okay. When?" He said, "Well, we leave Monday morning at 8 o'clock. I said, "Well, I was supposed to go out as training in Salt Lake City, but if that's what you want me to do, I'm sure that'll be okay." And he said, "Yes, I'm sure that will be okay." No problem there. I was probably one of the last people that many people expected to be working with him in that job, although my young childhood and different things I'd learned over the years, learning to cook in the kitchen because I liked eating better than from the back of the kitchen than from the front of the kitchen. It's always better in the back because you cook it yourself, do what you want. Plus, I did all the special dinners for clubs, and clubs always savor well. So I had some of the training, I guess, that put me in a position that I had the qualities that they wanted on the airplane to be a steward, which meant you were the steward, you cooked the food, you served it. Everything was on china, of course, in the plane and cooked from scratch. It wasn't the warm-up meals from the airplane. And you had to get the food in different languages. And I'd studied a little French in college, not a whole lot, but it improved at least in the food area, especially once I traveled. And then did that for a few years as his aide and also ended up doing some setup, hotel arrangements, customs, declaration, immigration. I mean, basically, I was the embassy for the work in a sense of doing all the clerical things, and you could also say I was the gopher, which would probably be the appropriate title as well, because I was one that everybody said, "Go for this, go for that." Whether you could get it or not was irrelevant. They just said, "Go for it." So I had to get a lot of things that I know I surprised people that I came back with, things that they sent me out for. "Oh, you got it. Sure, no problem." But it was an interesting time in my life, and gave me a lot of stories, which I always tell now because they do me well and they tend to keep you people awake, which is always something the minister tries to do when he's speaking. But it was fascinating also to witness what happened during those years and to see why Mr. Armstrong made a lot of the decisions he did. Since I'd grown up in the church and I'd known virtually all the players during those years, from various aspects, some very well because I grew up with their children. I know Ms. McCullough's daughter was the year below me, and so it was always, you always feel young. I still feel young, but I'm going to be 44 next month, so that, look how old that makes them. But it's a matter of older is wiser, and as we grow and go along that way, we pick up things. What I found did me real well in the travels and things with Mr. Armstrong was the Bible. The Old Testament especially, which is one of the things I complained about when they started trying to do IS things in our previous affiliation with trying to teach some of these, the New Testament theory type things as opposed to the Old Testament stories, because when you're a little kid, you want to hear about David and Goliath. You want to hear about Gideon's army. You want to hear about these things where God stepped in and did things. And it develops a childlike faith in you, as a young person, especially the child, that you realize God is in control. Now, I realize there's some things as you get older in life that you see things happen, you think, well, is God still in control? This isn't quite the way it's supposed to be. You're always told as a child to tell the truth and be honest, and God will work everything out. And then all of a sudden you tell the truth and you're honest, you get thrown out of the church. And you think, well, that doesn't quite what I had in mind with that saying. And yes, I've been thrown out of the church probably more than anyone. With just cause sometimes, I suppose, if what he thought I did was true. However, that wasn't always the case. And the people that were watching me go through this torment at times were thankful it was me and not them. I have a kindred spirit with Mr. Haver in that, and I'm not going to be the first one to stand up and raise my hand for persecution or stoning or martyrdom. I'm willing to take my share when it comes, but I'm not going to stand up and ask for it because it's no fun. And I've always prayed to God when I go through one of these trials, and every time I pray the same thing. And basically the prayer is, God, please let this be my trial and not my preparation for one. Because they get worse. They always get worse. And that is something that you have to realize, that trial and testing builds faith, and that faith has to be tried and tested a little harder and further. And it's nice to get a respite once in a while. And I feel like the last few years, in some ways for me personally, have been a respite. Having traveled for 12 years and being married, which a lot of that marriage really wasn't much of a... Michelle and I were on honeymoon for 7 years, basically, because I was only home a little bit at the time. So it was unusual. We didn't have children during that time, something we always wanted, we had planned, etc. Of course, people in the congregation were praying for my wife to get pregnant and have children, and we were praying that she wouldn't. And God heard us and not you, thankfully. But when we appreciated that, we understood what people thought. A lot of people thought we were barren or whatever, and none. We were just very careful, and part of being careful was never being there. It's real hard to be easy when you're not there. So we didn't have children during that time, and so now I have little kids, which makes people think I'm a lot younger than I am. So I have friends with kids in college that I went to college with. So it's interesting. Of course, Mr. Haver and I were in the same class in Big Sandy for a year and a half before I transferred to Pasadena. So I have quite a history with all these things. And then after, of course, being as the steward on the plane for a while and being there during the 70s when Mr. Armstrong was traveling quite extensively, probably more than he needed to in some ways. We were kept overseas at times for various persons, different reasons and agendas that weren't necessary to be as long as we were, but that wasn't my choice. And Mr. Armstrong was told different things, and we did a lot of visits that were very good, but we spent a lot of time overseas. We would spend time overseas. We spent as much as 6 or 8 weeks overseas and then come home for a week and then leave again. In 1975, the airplane was in the United States only 51 days. The rest of the time we were overseas. That's not any way to run a marriage, I assure you of that. Also, during that time, basically the stipulation was that we were allowed one 10-minute phone call home a week. Well, a 10-minute phone call a week to your wife isn't exactly the most pleasant thing, especially, now again, it wasn't back in the old days when it was Sprint. It cost a lot of money to call. A 10-minute phone call cost you $100, so I understood some of the budget crunch, etc. And I think Mr. Armstrong would let us do more than that. We were given orders by those below him. And you knew that if you said anything to him, he'd change it, but then you would probably be off your job within a month or two, too. So really didn't do any good to complain and say very much. Although I told him about that later, and he felt that was terrible and wrong and whatever. But, hey, life's life, and you go through it, and I didn't criticize him for it. The problem back then, though, was the fact communications weren't what they were today. And you'd call the operator up. First of all, you had to figure out what time zone you were in, and is your wife there, and is she awake, and which one of you wants to be awake at 3 in the morning talking, so the other can be in the daytime. And it was difficult because you'd figure out the time zone difference, then you'd call the operator and say, I'd like to place a call. And they'd say, oh, yes, sir, that'll take about 10 hours. Oh, great. By then you've left, gone somewhere else. And I remember getting calls at, 4 o'clock in the morning, sir, your call's ready. And then by that time, of course, my wife had gone to work or whatever the time was in Pasadena, and you didn't get to talk to her. And then when you got through, then you always had the problem of all the warbles and buzzes in the line, as well as the delay because of the times and the wiring and the satellites. Sometimes you'd say hello and hear yourself 3 times, and then you both talk at the same time, and the echo would come back, and then you start screaming because you couldn't hear each other. And usually I was mad at her by the time I finished a 10-minute phone call. Actually, more in love with her before I started the call than I was afterwards. And then the other thing, she always told me how much she spent, which irritated me because she usually spent more than I made. But when you're frustrated alone at home, you understand those things. So it was a challenge, to say the least, and had difficulties, but an education and something that she and I are thankful for in some ways and look at in other ways and think why and how. And the thing I've always told people is the fact that if God asks you to do something and calls you to it, he helps you through it. Other people have asked me before, how do you get this job? How do you do this? I said, well, don't ask for it. If God wants you to do it, he'll make you do it. And if he makes you do it, he'll help you do it. If he doesn't, you'll end up divorced. You'll end up with a broken family. You'll end up with children who raise themselves. You'll end up with all sorts of things that we've proven in the past in our history that people who have been zealous and for proper cause at times, it was the work and it was exciting and things, and we tend to see things a little differently when we're young. And you can do things that you choose to do for God that end up taking a toll on your family. And that's a difficulty that we recognize and we try to correct. And again, seeing some of that, not having children, and the one thing I could control pretty much was whether we had children. So my wife and I controlled that. And the other, we had to go with the flow. But again, it was difficult, and there were times when you wish you could quit. Michelle wanted me to quit a couple times, but I couldn't. I promised Mr. Armstrong I wouldn't quit. And there were times when it was very difficult. I took a trip once, came back after 3.5 weeks, which is early for us, and left a note in the refrigerator because 2 hours after we landed, we got a call that said leave again. I came home, left a note that I'd been home, and left again. And those aren't very fun to get when you come home. So I feel more for my wife than for myself, because I was always busy, and she was the one that had to come home and find these things. Yet at the same time, after the receiver, Mr. Rader, was gone and various things happened, I became Mr. Armstrong's aide. I didn't want that job either. I'm very intelligent. I always say I don't want the job because Mr. Armstrong, he asked me to be his aide, and I told him I didn't want it, and he let me go, first time, anyway. Because I told him, I've seen the job, I know what it is, and I don't want it, and I'm not sure it can be done. So he let me off. He asked me a couple weeks later to do it again, and there are other people pushing for me to do it at the time, I think, because they didn't want it. They wanted me to be there as well for whatever reason. So I turned him down again the second time, and he let me off. And then finally, about a month after he asked me the first time, he said, well, Aaron, I want you to be my aide. And I said, Mr. Armstrong, you know I don't want the job. Because I've already been traveling. I don't really want to. I'm going to travel anyway. I'm already a steward on the plane. I'll do whatever you want. But to be your aide as well is more than I want to do. And I'm not sure that's who God wants. And it's very difficult. But he said, well, Aaron, you're going to have to do it anyway. I said, well, Mr. Trashman, if you're going to order me to do it, I will do it. Because I will, you know, if you ask me to and you tell me to do it, I'll do it. Then he said, well, I don't even know if you can do it. I said, well, thanks a lot. Why do you keep asking me then? But if you want me, I'll do it. And I said, one thing I do see is an advantage, because at this time I was only in my, late 20s. And he said, I said, well, Mr. Armstrong, one thing that at least people don't have to worry about is about worrying about who the second witness is. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, the problem with the church over the years has been everybody's tried to come up with the two witnesses. Well, the second one, he said, who's the first one? I said, everybody thinks you are. I've never said that. Who said that? And I said, well, Mr. Armstrong, there's different things. You know, it's in the Bible. There are two of them, and obviously you're in the work, and it's kind of a logical assumption. And I said, most of the time, we've always made different people, whoever happened to be your assistant or lead evangelist at the time or whatever, quote-unquote, was in people's minds. Again, we're trying to get Christ to come back because this is a mess down here. We figured that out. We figured that out some time ago. We're still figuring it out. And so the way to get Christ back is to come up with the two witnesses, get the 3.5 years over with, and get on with it. So if we can just get those people to go out and do whoever they are, you know, stand up and go do something so we can get going. But he said, God's going to point out who they are. So the problem in the church to me was always a second witness, and nobody expected me at age, 27, 28 years old to be one of the two witnesses. So I said, at least that way I won't cause a problem. Because I said, normally you put somebody in as your aide, people think that's who should be next in charge, that's who you handpicked or whatever. And I said, if the person is right or wrong, good or bad, it's kind of irrelevant. Because if it's not who God wants, the person's going to fall on their face. And that's happened to other people. If you end up in something that really isn't who God wants, somehow or another he can remove you. Hopefully it's by not killing you, because the other one is more permanent in the present sense. But it was one of those things where I ended up doing a job that I didn't want, and the reason I really didn't want it, too, is because when there was another aide there, and Mr. Fay was his aide for a little while, for about 9 months. He lasted longer than a couple others. He only lasted a month apiece. But it was interesting that when you had an aide there, you had a buffer. You had someone that you could at least have a few minutes off now and then to go do something. And I never had a vacation when I worked for Mr. Armstrong because he didn't believe in vacations at the time, at least for himself, although he let other people have time off. And he knew there was a need for family, yet he would address the work in such urgent terms that it seemed like he should always be doing the work. And, in fact, there were times when he asked, well, why isn't anybody working on Sunday? So Mr. Armstrong, when are people supposed to be with their families? You teach families, yes. And I said, when are they supposed to go camping? When are they supposed to go fishing? When are they supposed to take your kids out? Well, okay. And, well, you and I can work, though. You don't have any kids. Yeah. Thanks a lot. I do have a wife, you know. But, so it was one of those things where he recognized that at the same time he had a sense of urgency about him that we all knew and appreciated in trying to prepare ourselves for what we have to do now and in the future. But having another aide there gave me a buffer that they could be with him when he's doing different things and I could have some time free to take care of the airplane. When I became his aide, it was interesting because I did not get another steward on the plane. I was still the gopher as well as his aide, which meant that I did all the work that everybody else did before, and plus mine. And it was challenging because I told Mr. Armstrong, I said, you know, it's funny, you asked me to be your aide. I said, in the past, people have had control of the money, control of the schedule, and they have been able to lie to you. And I said, I'm not going to do any of those, so I'm not sure I can do the job either. Because I'd seen over the years a number of people that had lied to Mr. Armstrong and the actions he had taken based on some of that misinformation, which was unfortunate. And he realized that later on when he would find out what the truth was. But it was, you know, some things that are hard to undo. But I was always trying to be honest with him, totally open, and I just told him, I said, I can only do what God wants done. I said, I'm not going to do some of the things the way it was done before. And he didn't even know how a lot of things had been done in the past, which I find fascinating because people who write about him now and say all these things that he supposedly knew and did and said and went through and various stories. And they probably figured out by now I haven't looked at my notes at all, so I'm just kind of rambling on here. But it's interesting, the history. And I'll make a point out of this before I close. I promise you that. I'll also look at my watch so we can finish on time. But it was interesting because when you would see the various things that happened in the past with him, and like Mr. Haber said, when you were there at some of these incidents and people write about them, and you talk to him, and you know the facts, then, I've read so much stuff, and everybody seems to want to send me their items, and I have. I've received literature from every splinter group, and people for us, people against us, people whatever, because they tend to send it to me for whatever reason. And so I've read a lot of these things, and hey, if I really want to look at it, I think, well, I must have been a good influence on Mr. Armstrong. He was such a bad guy. But I know that wasn't the case because being there when things happen, you realize that things didn't happen the way other people perceive them. Now, like in every rumor or every story you read, there is a certain element of truth to them. It's just a matter of what is the truth? How do you represent it? How do you say it? What's the story? Which part of it is true, which part of it's false? You know, which part, like Mr. Haber mentioned, Mr. Hume's thing about going overseas. Well, did he go overseas? Was that the rumor? He didn't go overseas. Maybe that was a lie. Well, maybe he did go overseas. Did the council know or didn't know? Well, maybe that was a lie. You know, which part of what is it there? And so when you read these things, you realize how many things are said that have a basis. One of the stories that I was reading about the other night was the yacht in Monte Carlo. And some of you may or may not have heard some of these things. And whether you have or not is irrelevant. But this was presented in the light that Mr. Armstrong was having this gay lifestyle, running around, enjoying life, and partying, and had this big yacht and all this stuff, and just spending all your tithe money and things irreverently and whatever. And I'm looking at this thing, and I think, this is incredible. Because having been there and knowing exactly what happened and how it happened, and in fact, I have a picture of the boat. Now it's called the Jolly Roger, if you want to look it up. It's probably still sailing, for all I know. Of course, it may have sunk. That's another possibility. But didn't sink while we were on it, thankfully, and that's the only thing I really cared about. But it was interesting because Mr. Armstrong, we went down to Monte Carlo because we had to sit, and we thought we'd sit there, because actually the hotel there was cheaper than it was up in Paris, and we had to fly on someplace else for another meeting. But his wife was there. This was 77, 78, I guess, would have been around that time. And we were down there in Monte Carlo, and the arrangements for the boat had been made up in Paris by someone who had had my position formerly, no longer with any of the churches, as far as I know. But he made arrangements for the boat, and Mr. Armstrong didn't know anything about it. But Ramona had taken her son with her on this trip. He was 16 at the time. This is from her first marriage a long time ago, which didn't last very long. But she'd had a son, and so the stepson of Mr. Armstrong, in that sense of their marriage. And she wanted to go down there, and she wanted to go out in the water because you sit in hotel rooms. Hotel rooms are hotel rooms. Hotel rooms are like prisons. They're nice prisons, but they're still a hotel room. And I sat in a lot of hotel rooms, and it's not a game show prize when you sit in a hotel room and work all day long. But it's more comfortable than being in jail, but still you're pretty much locked up where you are. But it was interesting because the person writing about this boat and all this thing that Mr. Armstrong supposedly knew about, I remember he was sitting in the room typing all the time. Now, he was asked every day, would you go out, would you go out? He said, no, I got busy, I'm working. Finally, he was told, well, you know, there's power on the boat. You can plug your typewriter and type. So finally, he agreed to go have lunch in the boat. So he went out to have lunch, took his typewriter with him, and worked, and then came back, and then typed. Now, he had the boat for several days, and that's true. And if anybody worked in accounting, they could probably saw the bill. Things came through, and I'm sure, you know, like I said, basis in everything. But later on, when I talked to Mr. Armstrong, he was told that this was a friend's boat, and that they'd letting us use it because they weren't there. When he found out we were paying for that, he hit the ceiling. And he was very upset. But what did he do at that point in time? Now, he didn't know anything about this. And what's always funny to me about some of these stories is the man's, you know, at that time, 84, 85 years old. Some of you are that old. Now, how much do you go out and party? Do you go out and water ski behind a boat? Do you go do that? I mean, you just don't do things like that age. And so to think you're going out and having a great old time doing all these things that are written up are very incongruous to me. I mean, it's total cognitive dissonance in many respects, some of the things people say. But yet, there's always some kind of truth behind some of it. So was there a boat? Yes, there was. Was it used? Yes, it was. Did he use it? He went out once for lunch and then typed part of an article on it and came back. Did he know about it? He knew there was a boat. He didn't know he was paying for it. When he found out he was paying for it, what did he think about it? He just was disgusted. Did he write about it in the worldwide news and things? No. Did he advertise it? No. Usually when something like that happens, you don't go around trying to make a big scene about a problem. He just made sure it didn't happen again. Did we ever have another yacht after that? No. Okay. So you correct things when they come, and you do things. There's a lot of stories and things like that, of course, that are said that have some basis in truth, but yet at the same time are totally wrong in what the message with them tries to convey. Another story that goes around, you read about various things, was the fact that he carried a couple of certificate of deposits in the six figures, they always say. Of course, in the six figures, that's exactly what they were. They were $100,000 each, and he carried two of them. And they were made out to him in the sense that what they say is they were made out to him so that the attorney general came after him, he'd be able to flee the country or whatever, which there's an element of truth to that. Because when the receivership came in 79 and the state took over the church for a time, there was a vulnerability the church had. And, of course, we set up an office in Tucson at that time. And it cost quite a bit. In fact, United right now is deciding, should we move headquarters? And what's the big thing? Dollars, the cost. And if you move a little ways, it'll cost you $500,000. You move to another state, it'll cost you $1 million to move everything and set up and do all this and all the costs involved in the transfer and all these things like that. So it costs money to set up. And there was a vulnerability that the church had. Now, since then, California's passed some laws to make it a little harder for them to do what happened in 79. But he carried those, and they were CDs. They were an investment. They were making money. They belonged to the church. They didn't belong to him. Yet he could cash them. And yes, if the state came back and tried to shut down the church, he could go set up an office. And that's what they were for, in case they were set up. Not for him personally, not for his use. His salary was different than that. But a lot of things were done that people didn't understand why, and they write their own reasons behind it. Mr. Armstrong would no more take the money and use it for himself than anything, because he was not a thief, and he was very careful with the money that he was given, per se. Now, there were times he spent things, and he grew up in an era when you paid more for something, it was worth more, and so a lot of times he would pay for things. I'd talk about sales, and he always thought sales, you're getting seconds or something, and I suppose back 1910, if you bought something on sale, it probably was a second, I don't know. But there were things that he grew up with from his childhood and middle years, etc., and then some of the things that he went through with poverty, in the Depression, etc., the early years of the church, that left certain marks on him. It was interesting, he wouldn't throw away a quarter of a sheet of paper. He could buy crystal obelisk lanterns for the auditorium, but yet when he wrote a note on a half sheet of paper, he'd tear the other half off and put it in his pocket. And he'd write on a quarter of that, he'd tear that in half, and he'd keep the quarter. You know, all these pieces of paper around, which, you know, didn't make sense to most of us. You know, you write something on the corner page, and now you're done with it. You wad it up and throw it in the trash can. He would say, you know, so there were different things that were unusual about him that others probably knew as well, although I knew a lot of them much better, because I had the last years of his life. And in the later years of his life, and again, I had more job security than others that got fired before me, too, because when I was with him, I was his eyes and ears. When he fired me, he couldn't read and he couldn't see, and he couldn't hear. Well, it doesn't take very long to realize when you're sitting there twiddling your thumbs that maybe that wasn't such a good idea, firing the kid. So I'd get asked back, and then I'd get to talk to him and explain what happened, and it made it nicer that way, although there were times that it was still difficult. But yet, oftentimes, he would forget things a lot quicker than I would, and that's naturally the way it goes. When you're the one on the other end of the knife, you tend to bleed a little more. So you hear these things, you go through them, and you realize a lot of the things he did, and you hear the comments people say, and everybody says, well, everybody knows Mr. Armstrong made mistakes. Well, what's so special about that statement? I don't like hearing it, because usually it means something different to different people and what they're saying and why they're saying it. Some people say it so they can go talk about what his mistakes were. Other people say it so they can maybe appear better themselves. Other people say it because they want to say there was something wrong, God wasn't leading him or whatever. And what I would say to that is that Mr. Armstrong wanted to do what God wanted. There were times when it was very unclear, and all of you are witness to that. There are times when it's very unclear exactly what you're supposed to do. Why did some people leave early in this latest escapade? Why did some leave in the middle? Why are some leaving now? Why are some people still sitting where they're sitting? Because it's not obvious always what God wants you to do. And so there are choices there that have to be made. And why and when you make those choices, God leads each of us individually in that. And it makes it difficult because we'd like for all of us to go en masse because there's comfort in numbers. But yet, when that doesn't happen, then you got to think, why am I doing what I'm doing? And should I? It also leads us to the fact that we judge other people in what they say and what they do, which is something we shouldn't do. God's teaching us a lot of lessons right now. Mr. Armstrong always said, well, half you people don't get it. Now we know which half. I didn't know it. I didn't understand it. I heard him say it, and I said, Mr. Armstrong, because you die, half the church is going to leave. Why? We have the truth. It's so solid. The Bible's so obvious. Well, obviously, I was sitting next to some people. It wasn't so obvious. I made the assumption, like many of you, that the person I sat next to believed what I did, when they didn't believe what I did, obviously. At least not to the depth and not with the understanding. And so different people reacted different ways. And each person meets their Waterloo and their time and their test at different times. And then when you see something's wrong, what are you supposed to do, and when are you supposed to do something about it? The reason I'm telling some of the things now is enough water's gone under the bridge. I made a lot of promises to Mr. Armstrong on his deathbed, which I kept as faithfully as I could. There are others who made promises who didn't do so, which is unfortunate. Unfortunate for them. And it leads me to question a lot of things and wonder what I should do. There were times when I wanted to stand up and say things that I didn't. I've gotten calls from members for the last 10 years, hundreds of them, from all different countries, in different languages even, with interpreters at times, asking questions about various things and telling people, hold on to what's true, yet at the same time trying to be loyal, because we were taught loyalty in government for so many years. When did it start for me? It started the day after Mr. Armstrong died. One of the promises that was made to Mr. Armstrong was broken the day after he died. And I fought a battle from that point on. And my wife and I knew a lot of things and saw a lot of things that we had to live with. Things that you felt like standing up and shouting and saying something. I did say a lot of things, but I said them to Mr. DeKotch. Because of the fact that's who I made the promise to Mr. Armstrong that I'd help Mr. DeKotch as much as I could, and that I would say what I saw to him if I felt he was doing something wrong or something that would cause the work trouble. So I did. I said them to him. I said them respectfully and positively as much as I could. At the same time, he would get mad at me, but then the points I would make would be logical, and so he would tend to calm down a little bit. At the same time, he didn't want to hear it, and each time something like this would happen, I would lose another one of the titles that had been given to me over the years, which I didn't care. I have a whole stack of cards that say I'm everything from the from a gopher to a vice president. And the vice president of different corporations, I could be a PT man, I could be the photographer, I could be a college representative, I could be a foundation representative, I could be a church representative, I could be a personal aide, executive aide, assistant, depending on what title. Strange, I joke with me, what are you supposed to be today? And we go on this visit. And we'd pull out one of the cards and decide who I should be. So I had all these titles that really didn't mean anything to me, but they were just, it's kind of like one of these private eye guys, all these cards, you know, pick out what you're going to be that day, which lent itself to some real unusual situations over the years. But at the same time, it was a matter of I wore a lot of hats, and whichever hat was appropriate for the particular meeting, I would wear at that time. And so I ended up being on most of the boards worldwide et cetera. And as I would bring things out to Mr. Dukach, I would find myself removed from the board and removed from the Council of Elders and removed from all the different things, vice president of the foundation. And usually, rather unceremoniously, I found out I wasn't vice president of the foundation from a student on the elevator, which I thought was